So rather than give like a more like typical seminar where I string a couple of pieces, a couple of work that I'm really interested in, or maybe push a certain research direction, thought it might be nice rather to just talk about a recent paper. And so to that end, I want to talk about this thing that I put out a couple of weeks ago with collaborators here at CERN and a postdoc Vedran at the MPI in Heidelberg. So the story basically goes something along the lines of, back in the day, a good 35 years ago, these two people, of course, worked out that you could actually look for neutrinos through neutral current interaction scatterings with nuclei. And of course, it didn't take too long before Witten and Goodman turned around and go, well, if it works for neutrinos, it should work for a dark matter candidate with electroweak-esque cross-sections. And so began, the era of direct detection. And 30, 40 years later now, we have very, very many direct detection experiments. We've been through many generations. Unfortunately, we haven't, of course, identified dark matter particle properties. But we have started to really drastically cut into interesting parameter space of the WIMP paradigm, and even starting to look into, the sub-GeV regime. And really what's kind of interesting is we've divested so much money into this kind of direct detection paradigm that now we're kind of sitting there asking ourselves, well, now we have these detectors that were built for a specific purpose. Can we kind of do something like we do for, Atlas and CMS and kind of turn them into a more like general purpose sort of detectors? And this is really where, searching for neutrinos and neutrino properties really kicks in. We've kind of gone the full circle now. We're back at neutrinos. Experimentalists are starting to think about, what can we do? What can we measure neutrino fluxes eventually using these dark matter experiments? But as a theorist, I'm sure many of you are in the same boat. I'm a little bit impatient. So rather than waiting for the experiment to get down to the neutrino floor, I like to ask, well, how can we bring the neutrino floor up to us? Is there any sort of viable parameter space for this to happen? Is there anything that's well motivated and worth looking for? Or am I just cooking up crackpot models in order to signal build? So this is really kind of the question we asked ourselves. Is there some sort of viable enhancement of neutrino interactions that we can hopefully see in the current generation of direct detection experiments? Now, of course, I have to be completely honest. I mean, I first started thinking about these things again based on the little prod that was the Xenon one-ton XS. That came out a few months ago. But I think in the end of the day, that's not the main motivation or the main push of the current project that I'm going to present. So the outline of the talk, there's basically three main parts. First of all, I'm going to talk about how we envisage generating neutrino magnetic moments in a way that doesn't have a ridiculous amount of fine-tuning and some sort of UV completions that are somewhat reasonable. So I'm going to go through that. And then I'm going to basically look at all the different ways you can probe these sort of neutrino magnetic moments through scattering and direct detection before turning to astrophysical and cosmological constraints. So I guess in the end of the day, starting with these magnetic moments, the first question I guess you might ask is, out of all the ways of enhancing neutrino magnetic moments, why did you, not enhancing magnetic, enhancing neutrino cross-sections, why pick the magnetic moment? And I mean, when we first started looking into these things, we first started playing with, light Z primes. But what you quickly realize is that you end up hitting a brick wall in terms of actually enhancing the signal enough and living with other astrophysical cosmological bounds. The constraints on actually putting light Z primes, mixing a neutrino into a sterile, coupling that to some sort of Z prime, the whole thing gets very complicated. You end up with millicharged particles, you end up with dark photons. The whole thing gets quite out of hand very quickly. And in comparison, the setups inside of a neutrino magnetic moment are a lot more elegant from a theory point of view. So if we just dial it back and start at the standard model, irrespective of if we add this right-handed neutrino state, or we generate neutrino masses with some sort of Majorana mass, so we just have our left-handed states, It's possible to get a neutrino magnetic moment using some sort of diagram where you exchange a W and electron, basically coupling the photon to either of these charged states. Now, in the case that I use Mariana states, the mixing, the neutrino mass insertion appears in a different place. And of course, I'm going to generate a magnetic moment not between a left and a right-hand state, but rather between a one flavor left-hand state and a different flavor left-handed state on the other vertex. But the point is that parametrically, these things end up being about the same size. So here in the standard model, these neutrino magnetic moments turn out to be around about 10 to the minus 19 Bohr magnetons. And just as a reminder, because before I started even looking into these things, I had no idea what a Bohr magneton is in reasonable units. So just a quick reminder. And even now that I've told you what a Bohr magneton is, it probably doesn't mean too much. So really, if you go and look at what we actually have in terms of experimental reach, this kind of tells you just how small this 10 to the minus 19 Bohr magnetons actually is. For detectors like Borexino or Xenon 1-ton, we're only really sensitive to neutrino magnetic moments at around about 2 times 10 to the minus 11 in terrestrial experiments. However, if we look at astrophysical probes such as red giants and white dwarfs, then we're able to get a reach that's significantly better than current terrestrial experiments. So in the end then, just looking at this figure in the bottom right from the recent Xenon 1-ton paper, you then really ask the question, is there an enhancement of the neutrino flow that's possible where you can have a signal in direct detection that isn't already ruled out by astrophysical or cosmological constraints? And so really this led us to start thinking about transition magnetic moments. And what I mean by transition magnetic moments here is not in between the flavors of the standard model neutrinos, but rather transition magnetic moment to a heavier right-handed neutrino state with a mass Mn. So again, this gives me exactly the same sort of operator. Just for to be clear, I'm always going to use this capital Nr to indicate a right-handed neutrino state that's not degenerate with the light neutrino states. So in this case, again, you get a similar diagram, your left neutrino in, your heavy right neutrino out, coupled to a photon. And there's been some studies in this direction by people who are Perimeter and also elsewhere, starting to really flesh out what's possible and what's not in this parameter space. However, from my point of view, really, like, what does this buy us? Well, this adding this sterile state with a mass really gives us another dial in order to avoid stellar cooling constraints. However, like most things, when you add a state in BSM physics, it's really like a double-edged sword. As soon as we add a new state, there's always something that really comes and stabs you in the back. And in this case, this new light state really can't be so heavy, because if you want to have something that's observable in direct detection or neutrino scattering experiments, then the mass of this guy is really bounded by what is the highest energy neutrino flux you can consider. And if you're going to consider solar neutrinos, well, you really can't go much above, you cannot go above 10 MeV. Because as soon as you go above 10 MeV, then you're stuck playing with either diffuse supernova relic neutrino fluxes or atmospheric neutrino fluxes. And these are much, much, much smaller compared to the solar neutrino flux. So you quickly end up with virtually no events in detectors of the current generation size. However, these two points aren't really the end of the story. Whenever you really try and increase the size of a magnetic moment, you really hit a problem. And that problem is really the fact that there's this direct connection between the magnetic moment and the bare mass of the neutrino. Now, in the case that you're considering an active neutrino magnetic moment, the problem is really, really bad, because that exact moment, when you get rid of the photon line, will also contribute directly to the light neutrino masses. And we know they have to be about 0.1 EV. So this really bounds the size. However, in the setups where you're actually upscattering into this heavier right-handed state, the situation is a little bit improved. Because here you now actually, by removing the photon line from that loop diagram, you're loop inducing a Dirac mass term and not just the pure active state. So now, if you look at the relationship between the magnetic moment and the bare Dirac mass that you would induce, here the lambda is the particles that would run in the loop in that red blob. The electron just enters from normalizing the magnetic moment to the Bohr magneton. If you throw in numbers for this expression, you insist upon the magnetic moment being about 10 to the minus 11, which is roughly observable in current generation experiments. You assume your new physics lives at around about the TeV scale, then this Dirac mass appears to be around about order MeV. And at first inspection, this is, you know, not so bad. I mean, you can live with this. However, if you want to do maybe the simplest thing possible, you know, let's do type one seesaw. Then you work out where your right-handed neutrino masses live with such a MeV Dirac mass. You quickly realize that they're in excess of a TeV. So this is, of course, again, means that you will have no sort of signal or hint of new physics in direct detection. So you're then left with the first very grim option. The first very grim option is you go, well, I want my guys to live in an MeV. You realize, well, I have a tree level mass. I have a loop induced mass. I could twiddle away and tune things. But this tuning looks, is just ridiculously hideous, because the amount of tuning you need to do to get this guy to live at the MeV scale while also having the correct active neutrino masses is really quite a catastrophe. And in my mind, there's only really, well, as far as I'm aware, at least, I'm sure you can model build more and more exotic ways out. But I think there's two reasonably nice ways out. The first one is through an inverse seesaw. This, of course, means that I add, in addition to this right-handed sterile neutrino, I'll also add a partner for this guy, a left-handed partner. And so what I'll end up having is I'll have two eigenstates, one massless, one at the scale of those partner masses. And then what I do is I use lepton breaking, some sort of lepton breaking source to lift the zero mass eigenstate to the correct active neutrino mass. Unfortunately, the consequence of this is I get a large mixing between these active and sterile states. And this can be very difficult to reconcile with cosmology. So really what I'm going to focus on is the second of these two options, which is this Volution mechanism from, I think in the 80s. And what this requires is an additional horizontal symmetry in the system. Before I go into the details about how that works, though, I really want to flesh out what are the actual particles that I'm envisaging in the loops that generate a large magnetic moment. Because, I mean, until I actually do this, this whole mixing versus mass arguments is not really very concrete. Is there any questions, confusions, comments before I move on to putting things in the loops?
Hi, Tommy. I just had a small question. When you say that if you remove the photon from your loop diagram, you get a contribution mm-hmm. to light neutrino masses. Mm-hmm. How do I see that that's a contribution to neutrino masses and not just renormalizing the wave function?
Well, I mean,
I'm thinking of lepton number violation should come in somewhere. And I guess the dipole operator you're thinking about is lepton number violating. Is that right?
I mean, in this case, if I just remove the photon line here in the vanilla case, you don't violate lepton number. But the point is that you then contribute to the Dirac mass, which doesn't violate lepton number. So it's true. It's just wave function renormalization, but it's a big correction. And you still have that tree level piece. So then you would do wave function renormalization and you would then have a big piece, a small piece. And if you wanted to make that small, then you'd have to tune.
Okay.
That's really where that tuning comes from that I'm talking about.
Thank you.
So really the picture I have in mind is I just wanted to add scalar leptoquarks because why not? The particular leptoquark I'm interested here is a 3^1 1/3 under standard model quantum numbers. And based on these quantum numbers, I can add the following two Yukawa couplings, coupling my right-handed neutrino to the scalar leptoquark and the bottom quark, the right-handed bottom quark, while the other coupling takes my third generation quark doublet and couples it to some flavor of the lepton doublets. So now if I draw this loop diagram, I have my scalar elliptic quark running in the loop. My photon can couple to this or the quarks. And I have a mass mixing or Higgs insertion on the bottom line. And so if I calculate the magnetic moment, for rather reasonable choices of the third generation Yukawa couplings of these leptoquarks, I straight away end up with a large magnetic moment when I take my vector leptoquark masses to around about a TeV. So that's basically the picture I have in mind for generating large magnetic moments. And I mean, in this setup, there's a very, very like rich phenomenology of these guys. For instance, I mean, these guys living at multi-TeV scales give very interesting collider signatures, contributions to G minus two of the muon, not directly from these two couplings. There's a third coupling you would have to add. These two couplings also give contributions to both neutral and charged current transitions. So they help alleviate the tension in the B anomalies. And also from my point of view, it's kind of nice that you can easily embed such a particle in something like RPV supersymmetry. So I mean, there's a lot going from it from a UV perspective. So
what's the flavor structure of these things?
Yeah, this is what I wanted to ask too.
So at the moment, I'm literally just going to couple to third generation quarks. I have no underlying flavor model in mind here, only motivated by the fact that if I couple to third generation stuff.
Can you generate lepton flavor violation due to this? Can you generate mu to three? You're assuming now, or do you you have to place some sort of constraints to the type of leptons you couple as well, I would imagine.
My understanding, and I haven't looked into the details of this, is that you're actually not so sensitive to which flavor lepton you couple to. The most important part is that you only couple to third generation quarks.
Mm.
And if you couple to third generation quarks, the claim is that you should be safe from even lepton flavor observables. But I haven't done a detailed study to look into exactly where you have to live. Around about a TeV scale for these leptoquarks should be okay, but the devil is in the detail.
I mean, one trivial way that people play around with these things to just avoid, say, like lepton flavor violation, mm-hmm. is that you give lepton number also to the scalar lepton. So then the interaction is lepton flavor conserving, and then you only have the violation in the quark numbers. But then you have more than one scalar leptoquark. You have to put them, so you can play with that.
In a second, I'm going to add another scalar leptoquark for a reason, so we can maybe revisit that. And I'm also going to do a rather heinous thing to it. Well, it's not too bad in the grand scheme, but we can maybe revisit that in a second. So what I need to do is I still need to reduce the size of the loop-induced mass, Dirac mass term I induced through this removing the photon line. And to do that, I again need to use this mechanism I mentioned before. So just the kind of way that this mechanism was originally proposed was that I take some sort of like horizontal SU2 symmetry and I put these two neutrino states in a two of this SU2 symmetry. Essentially what happens then is I see that the contraction with the dipole actually gives me an SU2 singlet, while the contraction without the dipole is an SU2 triplet. So if this symmetry was exact, then this bare mass, this bare loop-induced Dirac term would be completely forbidden. However, of course, this is not an exact symmetry of the theory, so there is some small breaking depending on exactly what you do. So in the model at hand, what I actually want to do is I want to add a second leptoquark. And the second leptoquark is this R2 tilde, which is a 3216, and give it the following Yukawa interactions, again, interaction with the quarks and leptons, and again, one with the right-handed neutrino. And then what I want to do is I want to take a specific component of that R2 tilde leptoquark, the minus one-third electric charge one, and put it in a SU2 doublet with the component of the S1 dagger. And if you do this from a diagrammatic point of view, you actually see that when I remove, when I have this diagram here, these two diagrams actually exactly cancel because of the, while if I attach a photon line, because of the opposite electric charges, this extra minus sign pulls out exactly a minus sign similar to the SU2 singlet contraction of the dipole. And therefore these two diagrams cancel without the photon, but also cancel without the photon, but don't cancel when I add the photon line. So that's kind of the diagrammatic way of seeing it in this sort of setup. And here, of course, again, this is most certainly not an exact symmetry. What you're actually going to have is you're going to have a lot of breaking through electroweak correction simply because you're taking a state which has a, which is a two of SU2, you're taking one of the components. There's other states with different electroweak or electromagnetic quantum numbers. These guys are going to give corrections to this picture. So even though you might forbid this guy at the loop level, there will be at least two loop corrections that will again reintroduce a Dirac mass. And so if you take this previous estimate from before and you add the add a one loop factor, what you basically end up finding is that rather than your Dirac mass sitting at a KeV, at an MeV, it's going to sit a little bit below one KeV for the same choice in parameters. I should note that there's other correction, other breaking terms, but these are subdominant to these loop corrections. So what this essentially means is that if I go back to trying to get the right masses and mixings in my neutrino sector, I only need a small tuning to reduce the neutrino masses to 0.1 electron volts. The consequence of which is that I end up with a relatively large mixing in my neutrino sector, which is just, again, the ratio of approximately the ratio of this Dirac and right-handed mass. Actually, this should be somewhere between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus 4. It's not exactly 10 to the minus 3. So from my point of view now, what I'm interested in is, well, in this setup, am I is my phenomenology dominated now by the large magnetic moment, or am I still dominated by this reasonably large mixing angle? For instance, from a naive estimate from the cosmology, I can, of course, just roughly estimate through dimensional analysis these two rates. So the first rate would be decays and inverse decays of my right-handed neutrino into a left-handed neutrino and a photon directly through the tree-level operator, or through the magnetic moment. And the other estimate I could think of is something like a kind of four Fermi operator where I mix one of the neutrino states through this mixing into the heavy right-handed state. And basically what I want to ensure is I want to ensure that below a certain temperature, the rates are dominated by the magnetic moment. And if you do this comparison, what you find is that, again, you seem to hit approximately this ballpark where you need a magnetic moment in the order of 10 to the minus 11 or bigger for this to be ensured. And again, this is a reasonably conservative estimate because I'm insisting upon this point being at the GeV scale. In reality, I could live a little bit lower, and also this max mixing is a tiny bit smaller than 10 to the minus 3. So this basically leads to the main assumption for what I'm going to do in the rest of the talk. And that's namely, I'm going to focus almost purely on this reasonably model independent magnetic moment induced contribution. And I'm going to neglect any sort of mixing contribution. What this means is that my limits are rather conservative in the sense that if I add this mixing component, the constraints are going to get tighter. There's no way that this mixing can save you. It's only going to make matters worse. So on that note, before I continue into the neutrino scattering direct detection realm, are there any major concerns or issues or clarifications?
Can you clarify what you mean about the star? How do you expect the production through the mixing angle affecting everything?
So, I mean, one of the things that I realized when I was only writing this talk is I've neglected this Dottelstrom-Wilson production.
Yeah. How important it is?
I don't think it's so important because as soon as I have the magnetic moment, this is going to give a way of scattering my neutrinos, both sterile and active. It's going to give them a way of scattering quite frequently. So I think this is going to suppress the contribution simply because they won't have time to oscillate now. But the reason I put it as a as an amber light on the traffic light is I haven't looked into the details yet, so I'm not 100% sure. Mm-hmm. That's my naive expectation. Yeah, because typically, like the usual way of suppressing this production is you do this secret interactions mechanism, and there you're basically taking your sterile neutrinos and giving them like a dark photon interaction. And the fact that this coupling is quite large and the interactions occur quite frequently, this definitely suppresses this production mechanism. So I'm thinking that you can do something similar using the magnetic moment.
Okay, thank you.
And were you guys thinking about lepto quarks because you also wanted to explain the flavor anomalies, or just because it was the only completion that was reasonable?
I mean, some of the authors on the paper have slight biases. But I mean, as a general rule of thumb, you can do these sort of setups either with things like vector leptoquark, scalar leptoquark. You could also do it with just charged scalars. The thing that was really nice, I think, about using the leptoquarks is you just naturally get these big Yukawa couplings entering from the third generation stuff. I mean, I do admit you have to go back and explain the flavor structure, but I don't think that's an impossible task with these Yukawas. I mean, again, you're going to start ending up engineering models similar to Admir's models, where you have these 4-3-2-1 models, and you have large couplings to third generations, and then you generate the couplings to first and second generations through insertion of vector-like quarks and leptons. So I think you could do something similar there, but again, the devil's in the details.
So just to make sure, when you say that you think maybe the dipole can do something similar to secret interactions, you mean that the mixing in the early universe can depends on your magnetic moment? Is that what you mean?
I mean, the effective mixing, right? Rather, when you calculate the effective sin squared 2 theta, exactly.
Okay.
I mean, then I would worry about when I go into regions of parameter space where the magnetic moment becomes quite small, I'd start to be a bit worried about those, but for the region that I'm mainly interested in, I think you're going to be in business.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Alrighty. So moving on to the more, I think, pedestrian part of my talk, the neutrino scattering and direct detection part. So here I'm mainly going to focus on electron recoils because they turn out to have the best sensitivity. So if I want to know how many events I have in these styles of detector, then of course the magical ingredient is the differential event rate, which is a differential with respect to the recoil energy of the incoming thing off whatever detector material or electrons, nucleons, whatever you're considering. So here what I'm envisaging is I have a incoming solid neutrino flux comes in via the dipole operator, upscatters to my heavy right-handed neutrino state through the exchange of the photon. So the ingredients in these sort of differential event rates is basically the number of scattering targets, the solar neutrino flux, as well as the cross sections and kinematics. Now, for anybody who hasn't looked into these things lately, I've just put in this bottom right-hand plot, basically the recoil energy against event number for a certain chosen exposure. And I've overlaid the xenon 1-ton data points with the Borg-Zeno data points. And the point here is just basically to remind you that, as you would expect, dark matter detectors are low threshold experiments and therefore can probe low recoil energy. Whereas neutrino experiments, in particular Borg-Zeno here, is a little bit higher on the recoil energy front. And of course, therefore sits in this window up here, more or less above xenon 1-ton. Also bear in mind that Borg-Zeno is this huge detector. It's 100 odd tons. And the exposure they have is of the order of 1,000 days. While xenon is much, much smaller, the data here is for 0.65 ton years. So the first ingredient, and probably the most important, is the incoming solar neutrino flux. So fusion in the sun, of course, goes via the two main branches, the PP chain and the CNO cycle. And so what I've plotted is I've plotted the complete spectrum for a theoretical model from Bacall and company. I think the most important thing to note here is that there is a huge dominant flux in this quite complicated spectrum. And this dominant flux is the PP neutrinos from the beginning of the PP train. However, even though this flux is very, very large, an important thing for what follows is that the maximum neutrino energy is quite small in comparison to something like the boron 8 tail, which goes off to around about 10 MeV. In addition, there's also these three lines that turn out to be quite important, especially this one with the higher amplitude here. Just as a little side note, Borroxino a couple of months ago at the neutrino conference actually finally presented evidence for the observation of the CNO cycle. So that corresponds to looking for these three subdominant black, blue, red lines that are kind of hidden below these lines. So the fact that they've actually finally seen the CNO neutrinos from the sun is really quite remarkable, because it's quite a challenging measurement. So for what follows, I'm always going to be using this theoretical model as the central values in order to more easily compare for constraints from Borroxino and xenon 1-ton. So based on this, the features in the solar flux, the cross-section and kinematics actually become quite important. Now, don't hate on me too much. This is just, you know, high school theoretical physics. Here, I'm just considering a scattering to a light state, a state that's mass degenerate with the active states. And if you do this, then you get this not at all surprising cross-section that goes with alpha mu nu squared. The important piece is that at low recoil energies, you start to get this one on ER enhancement. And if you look at the kinematics, the angle between the outgoing electron and the incoming neutrino, and you just plot where this value, you can basically just read off straight away what the maximum recoil energy is based on cosine theta equals one. And unsurprisingly, as you increase the energy of the incoming neutrino, the maximum recoil energy increases. Completely stock standard. However, what happens is as we go to heavier and heavier right-handed neutrino masses, the kinematics and the available range for enhancing the cross-section for different recoil energies changes. So as I go from zero all the way to 750 keV for my right-handed neutrino mass for something like the 1.44 MeV neutrino line, then I go from this solid line to all the way down to zero to something like this dotted line. So what this means is that by increasing the right-handed neutrino mass, all I'm doing is enhancing the spectrum in this narrow window between these two endpoints of the blue dotted line. And this is going to be quite important because I have these different neutrino lines, I have these different continuous spectra. This kind of kinematical reality heavily impacts the shape of the final spectra. And so showing them on screen, you get something like the following. Now, I have to first start with the solar standard model. So this is the black lines. This is just the standard solar model flux with standard model cross sections. So you see that at low energy, there's no enhancement. And then as we go to higher and higher recoil energies, we start to see some of the features that are present in the solar neutrino flux. The same is also true if I just plot a single flavor. Here I've plotted the muon neutrino flux. Again, all it is a suppression with comparison to the full all flavors. So then the two benchmark points that I've chosen to show is one is where the right-handed neutrino mass is for all intents and purposes effectively massless. So what this means is that high recoil energies, there's only very small enhancement. And as I go to smaller and smaller recoil energies, I start to get this one on ER enhancement that I expect from the cross-section. And incidentally, this is kind of exactly what you're after for explaining the xenon 1-ton data. You see the second bin here where you see the slight enhancement. Of course, these spectra here don't have detector efficiencies nor the binding energies of the electrons folded in, because then I couldn't compare the two experiments. But basically, the efficiency of xenon 1-ton falls off very quickly and helps to also fit this first data point. However, what you can also do is you can start to consider much, much larger magnetic moments and much heavier right-handed neutrino masses. And what you do, what happens now is that you basically forbid, you don't enhance the PP solar spectrum. So you don't enhance that big part of the solar neutrino spectrum. You only enhance the higher energy parts. So this bump here comes purely from the boron 8 contribution. So that high energy shoulder of the flux. Whereas this plateau here at higher recoil energies has to come from some other flux component that has a smaller maximum energy. And actually this plateau comes from enhancing that highest lying neutrino line, the PUP line. So what you see is that basically the kinematics then selects out different components and enhances it in different places. So even though you could use this red line to fit the excess at lower recoil energies, this plateau that shows up is difficult to reconcile with the higher energy bins of xenon 1-ton above 30 MeV, and is also impossible to reconcile with Brock xeno data. So that's the basic story here when you have these sort of points. To better quantify this a bit, I wasted quite a bit of time doing a full fit to the available data over the full energy regimes, basically allowing everything to vary in the fits with pull factors based on what the experimentalists expect for the various backgrounds and their ranges. For xenon 1-ton, I do a very good job of reproducing their results. However, for boric xeno, there's a small mismatch. Actually, since we put the paper out, I've been in touch with one of the guys who did the actual magnetic moment analysis from boric xeno. In their paper, their constraint is actually 2.85 times 10 to the minus 11 Bohr magnetons. So this would seem to suggest that my result was pretty good. However, they played some tricks that are not actually present in their paper of ways of actually selecting out this PP neutrino flux. And this is the principal reason why they have such a good constraint. If you actually don't play those same tricks, which you just can't do with the data that they provide you, then the constraint that they apparently get is 4 times 10 to the minus 11. So the constraint I get here is a little bit more aggressive, but this is predominantly due to missing systematics. Because this detector is so huge, how basically the reconstruction of the recoil energy at the bottom versus the top of the detector changes. It also changes as a function of time. And these are just effects that you really can't model given what's available publicly. So if I put all that together, I end up with the following figure. In gray is the well-known terrestrial exchange from older experiments, CHARM2, NOMAD, and Miniboon. What I'm doing is I'm actually just plotting this for muon flavor only, just so that I can put other constraints. What one finds is that, first of all, there's this region that fits the xenon 1-ton excess quite well, below about 0.1 MeV. This is again exactly the regions in the right-handed masses where you can enhance that PP flux. As soon as you go to higher right-handed neutrino masses, you have to enhance a different part of the spectrum. And as soon as you start enhancing different parts of the spectrum, you start ending up with features all over the place. And this makes it difficult to reconcile with other experiments or even just the full data range of xenon 1-ton. If you just consider the 0 to 30 keV bins, it's quite easy. So then what I've also done is I've assumed that xenon 1-ton excess is fitted by a anomalously large tritium background. And in that case, derived limits on this scenario at 90% confidence level, as we all expect that there's probably some sort of mismodeled background that probably explains this excess. So this might be more useful in the future. And I've also placed the same sort of line for boric xeno. Just for comparison, I also put the nuclear recoil line at the top just to show you how nuclear recoils perform for these magnetic moment scenarios.
What's Darwin?
Darwin is the end evolution of xenon 1-ton. Xenon 1-ton has 0.65 ton-year exposure. Darwin is projected to have 200 ton-year exposure. So this is just a rescaling of the xenon 1-ton limit, including tritium, where I just throw pseudo data based on the background modeling and then look at how the limit scales based on this extra exposure, assuming the backgrounds are similar. So this is just a naive extrapolation. So you see that Darwin's going to be able to go down to 10 to the minus 11, of course, completely test this region. But I mean, this region's already going to be well tested by a xenon n-ton. So we're not going to have to wait a ridiculous amount of time to find out what's going on here.
I guess also Borexino also has more data, right, to place stronger constraints.
I mean, this data set that I used to place this constraint was, I think it was about 1,300 days. I'm not sure how much more data they have in addition to that. I mean, they obviously have more because they've been able to do things like the CNO measurement, but I'm not sure.
Do you remember the year that that corresponds to?
It's a 2018 paper.
Okay, so there is certainly data until 2019, but probably not a lot more.
Yeah, so I would naively guess it's probably not going to move so much, but you never know. Experimentalists have a way of surprising us at every twist and turn.
Can I just ask you, though, in the region of the xenomonton excess that you have, what are the typical lifetimes of your new heavy neutrino?
I actually have that in two slides.
All right, okay. We can get back to it.
Because now I wanted to talk about the more sort of problematic slides. Not problematic, but the more stringent sort of constraints. Actually, I just realized it's not actually the next couple of slides. It's a little bit further, but if you don't mind holding on, it might be more appropriate then.
Sure.
So the first thing you'd be concerned about is stellar cooling. Although I claim to tell you that I engineered these scenarios to be okay. Nevertheless, you still have to be careful. Plasmon decays are a real menace. So plasmons are just a collective excitation of our charged electrons in a plasma. Basically, the way we can think about it is we can think about the plasmon having a mass that's roughly proportional to the temperature of the star. So we get a feeling for what sort of right-handed neutrino masses are therefore probable via these sort of like on-shell decays when this plasmon mass is sufficiently high. So what we did is we just basically recast limits from this paper from last year, which is the most up-to-date constraints using red giants on magnetic moments. So for the zero mass case, they get a limit of about 2.2 times 10 to the minus 12. We calculate the energy loss per unit volume, including the right-handed neutrino masses, and also, of course, the required Thomson scattering rate, and then basically use this to rescale the limit as we go to higher and higher masses. So when you do this, what you actually end up is you end up with two branches of this limit. The first branch is where the mass is less than the plasmon frequency, omega p. And what you get then is you get this quite stringent limit down to very small coupling values of the magnetic moment that quickly dies off as the right-handed mass increases above the plasmon frequency. Then as soon as you get to higher masses, then the relevant process becomes this kind of scattering process where you basically end up creating a right-handed neutrino and a left-handed neutrino. And this kind of dies off a bit slower compared to the on-shell branch. The important point to notice here is that, of course, these stellar cooling constraints rule out a right-handed neutrino mass of zero, as you would expect. But the important point is that they kind of die off sufficiently quickly such that there is still a region of parameter space where you could expect an upscattering signal in these experiments and not be in conflict with red giant measurements. So
is there any sort of expectation regarding the flavor anomalies? Where if you wanted to explain, since you're adding leptoquarks, and I guess this is the favorite model to have to source this type of moment, this magnetic moment. What is there a favorite value for the magnetic moment? What is there a preferred parameter space if you wanted to reconcile both at the same time, or just the flavor anomalies?
I haven't looked into, is there an overlap with the exact value you need for the Yukawa couplings and the flavor anomalies? I mean, naively, just from a 1 TeV leptoquark, I'm going to definitely live around this ballpark here. The point is that to explain the current values of the B anomalies, you're going to have to end up with quite large Yukawa couplings of these leptoquarks.
Yeah.
Which would drive this value up a little bit from what I showed on the previous slide. So my intuition is that you might end up in around about the same region, but we didn't want to fit too many anomalies at once. We're a bit hesitant, but maybe I should go back and do that exercise now I have everything set up.
Yeah, thank you.
Because it is kind of interesting to see if it all works out.
Yeah, I mean, the anomaly is there, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and we're talking about now fitting anomalies. So which is your favorite? I think or you can think about it, is there another way, if it's sourced by leptoquarks, does that anomaly predict, does the flavor anomaly predict any other experiments, right?
Yeah, no, that's definitely an exercise we should do now that everything is set up. I mean, there's only so much I can do in a month. But no, it's definitely worth looking into. However, like, I don't know, kind of the elephant in the room is if you actually put supernova constraints on this plot, right? So if I take the supernova limit from the 1803 paper on transition magnetic moments to sterile neutrinos, then I, of course, basically rule out most of this plane. And so really the only way out from these sort of constraints is that you think supernova, so something funky going on with supernova. And I mean, I don't have my own personal prior on this. I mean, there's been lots of suggestions that, for instance, you could source neutrinos from accretion onto protoneutron stars or black holes, or, you know, you could have some sort of different neutrino different core collapse mechanism responsible for supernova 1987, all the way to, you know, what is the remnant of supernova 1987, is it a black hole or a neutron star? And kind of all these questions are still a little bit up in the air. So it does call into question how robust this constraint is. But if I was a gambling person, I'd probably put my money on delayed neutrino mechanism, and therefore this region is completely excluded. But until that point, I think it's good to rule it out in a number of ways. So this is the reason why I've only put this as a dash line, and I hope one is not too upset by this. So putting the supernova constraints aside, there's basically one last set of constraints before I wrap things up. And this is, of course, cosmological constraints. So if I take that rate, this inverse, the scattering rate of electrons, and calculate a decoupling temperature, what you find is that the decoupling temperature for, again, this typical 10 to the minus 11 value is not very high. It's kind of quite disconcerting. So with this sort of value, you would expect to have a reasonably large relic population. I mean, you're just around the point where you can start to dilute things with the QCD states decoupling. So what you kind of expect as you would go higher is that you would get an even larger abundance of these guys because they'd stay in equilibrium for longer. So the idea really is that there's two consequences of this relic population. Of course, if they're sufficiently light, they contribute to ineffective during BBN. And also, if you have a large enough population of them, then the decays are going to do very nasty things to BBN and CMB. So you had an idea of how this parameter plane plays out with the lifetime. You see that around about this region you would need to fit xenon 1 ton, you're around about 10 to the 6 seconds. Going out here, you hit the 10 to the 2 second contour. So really you're always in regions where you're quite worried about what the hell's going on. So what we actually want to do is we want to look at this a bit more carefully. These decays lead to two main effects depending on when they happen. So the first window that they can happen in is basically during the first part of BBN. Basically, if these guys decay in that period, or they're driving like a small matter dominated phase, the end result is roughly the same. You're going to have an increased expansion rate, you're going to have a larger neutron to proton ratio, and less time for neutrons to decay and for BBN to proceed to make the heavier elements. On the other side of the coin, if the decays are more longer lived and the decays happen after BBN, then all of these decays are going to do is inject additional photons, and they're going to decrease the baryon to photon ratio. And this is kind of a massive bummer because this is something that we measure via CMB observations. So we have a fixed value for what this has to be during recombination. So what this means is we have to kind of backtrack and change BBN so that we make enough baryons so that when we decay, we dilute it to the right value. And so this means has some consequences on BBN. It's not quite as bad as this first phase, but it still needs to be taken into account. So to do this, we just used a home modified version of this BBN code, alter BBN. As input, we need all these parameters in our BSM model that we're considering. And to do this, we kind of considered a simplified setup. We didn't integrate, we didn't consider the full phase space distributions of all the different particle species. We solved the integrated Boltzmann equations. And what we did is we also did exactly the same procedure for an ALP setup and compared to the results of the DAISY people where they did the full calculation. So this is kind of the setup we're using right now. I think I'm planning at least on doing this properly because I don't think it's too difficult. In the setup, of course, we have the dilution factors, and then we have the most important rates in the game. So again, the decays, inverse decays of the right-handed neutrinos, we have the electron upscattering, as well as the standard model QED processes that control electron-positron annihilation. So what we do is we just look at the equilibrium distributions and we track how these start to differ depending on exactly what's going on. When does the right-handed neutrino become scalars matter? When does it become non-relativistic? When is the right-handed neutrino bath decoupling from the photon and the neutrino bath? And also how do these decays, which decay to a photon and a neutrino, how violent an effect does this have on an effective really depends on how long this point is after the neutrinos have decoupled, because of course the redshifting affects the two different baths differently. So if you put all of these things together and suffer for a while, you basically end up with the following results. So on the left-hand side, I'm showing the helium abundance normalized to the baryon energy density. On the right-hand side, I show the same thing for delta N effective at CMB. And in both these plots, there's basically two islands. So the first island occurs in this, the first island occurs in this top right region. So here in this top right region of the figure, I have very heavy right-handed neutrinos that are very, very long lived. So basically what's gonna happen is that these guys are going to drive a small period of matter domination. So their energy density is gonna become very large compared to everything else. And then they're gonna decay. And because there's so much of many of these guys through that period of matter domination, of course, this has a very violent effect on both N effective and the helium abundance. Now, if you go to the left-hand region, then the opposite is true. These guys are very light. So they're relativistic during BBN, but they also decay quickly. So what this basically means is that you're just going to end up dumping more energy and having a faster expansion rate in this region, which is also ruled out. Then what happens is there seems to be this sweet spot here where these two effects partially cancel. And because you're decaying to a neutrino and a photon, you can kind of live both from the helium 4 point of view and also from the N effective point of view. This throat is not quite as large for N effective as it is for the helium abundance, helium 4 abundance, but it doesn't matter in the end because Planck and delta N effective still sets a constraint. So if I take these results and map them onto my favorite parameter space, then this is basically how the story unfolds. So we now have these brand new constraints from CMB and BBN overlaid on the previous figures. And what you basically see is that this throat from BBN and CMB kind of occurs in exactly the region you're after. And so whether you can live at 2 sigma for the xenon 1 ton excess or not really depends on how much you believe the central value of our current CMB and CMB polarization experiments. So what we're kind of seeing, and this is also true of there's a polarization measurement from a few weeks ago. What we're kind of seeing is that the central value of this an effective measurement is much below 3. So when you take the symmetric plus minus error bars, you see that it becomes really, really difficult to live with any enhancement above the standard model 3.046 result. So it really becomes a question, like if you believe that the central value is spot on of these experiments, then you would want to be living on this dashed line. if you think for some reason that there's some sort of downward fluctuation that's not believable, then you could probably, you can live on this solid blue line. So that's kind of the story there. I think, you know, these things are always going to be shifting as we get better and better measurements of ineffective. So it'll be interesting to see how these central measurements go and how far to the right we end up getting pushed.
Why is just ineffective modification to the CMB, or do they mess up also the neutrinos somehow? You're adding interactions to the neutrinos. Can you just like capture all the CMB bounds as ineffective?
Sorry, what do you mean? You mean spectral distortions of the neutrino spectra, or?
Yeah, I mean, you're messing up with the neutrinos themselves. You're adding interactions of the standard model neutrinos to stuff.
Yep.
And yeah, so ineffective is one of the constraints that you could set from the CMB, but have you guys thought about other possible effects on the CMB which are not captured by ineffective?
Yeah, so of course the main one you would be concerned about is you would be concerned about distorting the CMB spectrum from a black body, right? So this would be again through injecting photons or electrons. But what you actually find is that for the ranges of the figure that we've considered here, the lifetimes are such that the injection of photons actually happens sufficiently early that the perturbations to the spectrum have sufficient time to die down before you measure the CMB.
Or shifting the peaks, I don't know, left and right of the CMB or something.
I mean, those won't be affected. I mean, the best measurement's always just the black bodiness of the CMB. Because in the end of the day, like, you're kind of taking this ineffective constraint, because in the end of the day, what you should do is you should take your BSM model and do a full fit to cosmology, right? Like, all I'm doing is I'm taking lambda CDM plus ineffective and taking that one number and comparing it to my BSM model where I've calculated the abundances.
Is this like clearly free streaming all the neutrinos you have?
Will I mess with free streaming of the neutrinos?
Like,
that's a good question. I think the decoupling should happen sufficiently early. If I go back a plot, for all of this region of parameter space, you see that the interactions are freezing out already at MeV scales. So for free streaming, there shouldn't be a problem, because that's, as far as I know, is a probe at much, much lower energies or later times, right? Right, I think you're completely safe from free streaming constraints for these parameter ranges considered. Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting observation from doing these calculations is the presence of this throat. Now, I'm pretty confident that the throat exists based on the simplified calculation we did. Now going and doing the full calculation with tracking the full phase-space distributions of the particles, this can definitely lead to small shifts in where this throat is. But I hope on a log-log plot, it won't be any sort of drastic shift. But we will see. So I guess...
Hey, Toby, this is Ryan Plested. I had a question.
Yeah.
So in your paper, you discuss potential ways to evade these cosmological bounds.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically... I guess the heavier, basically your lower end of that throat is just that the lifetime is 1 second, like mm-hmm. roughly. But the upper portion, which I believe in your previous plot corresponds to any lifetime, but lighter than about an MeV,
mm-hmm.
This gray region. So if you were to add an invisible decay,
yeah.
Presumably, you could avoid the baryon to photon ratio problems.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess you're still going to get, you're still going to have to decay into something, and that something is going to affect an effective, I would think.
Yeah, I think you're also always doomed to having a larger expansion rate during BBN.
Right. So, but does that, am I right in reading, So if you add, basically my question is, if you added this invisible decay, do you imagine this vertical kind of line in this plot on the left would move? Is there any way of relaxing that constraint, or is it only the top right-hand corner that you can?
I think it's really only the top right-hand corner I can relax. This kind of wall here, I mean, I'm going to have an extra relativistic degree of freedom during BBN. Mm-hmm. And to me, this seems like something that you just can't fix. That's my present belief, but I mean, people always have a way of coming and model building and doing very spectacular things. So I'm like, oh, I didn't see that coming. But I think I just don't see how you could relax this bottom left corner.
Okay, thank you.
The only way you could relax that bottom left corner is somehow playing with the freeze out so that you didn't actually produce that many. So that even though when you decay to photons or something else, you don't change the expansion rate, right? That's the only way out, I think. But then you're deviating away from a naive magnetic moment. So, I mean, then you're considering a different model. So I've gone a little bit over time. I was actually trying to write a short talk. And apparently I failed. So I think the summary basically is that we looked at neutrinos with magnetic moments that upscatter into sterile neutrinos. And I think the conclusion, especially from the previous figure, is that if you did see something in direct detection that you could pin as coming from neutrinos and had the right sort of spectral shapes that I talked about, then this is probably an indication for some sort of exotic new physics that fixes any of these constraints. And I think finally, like, we need to improve these calculations during BBN and maybe do the full calculation and also add active sterile mixing just to see how bad things become, as well as, I should have added this also, looking into other effects with the UV leptoquarks. Thanks for the questions and everyone's attention. I appreciate it.
So can I ask one more question?
Of course.
About the decay of your N4, mm-hmm. Don't you produce a lot of these states in the sun as well? And then just taking some scaling from your parameters, it seems like this would match more or less Earth-Sun distance. And then can't you just get the decay of N inside of xenon orb or xeno and so on?
You're saying I produce a right-handed neutrino from the sun.
That's right.
And I see it decay into a photon and neutrino in the direct detection experiment.
That's right. Yeah. So I'm taking a lifetime of 3,000 seconds that you had somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the flux, the rate's going to be tiny, right? Because I need it to decay in it's a really bad way of doing a beam dump experiment, right?
Yeah, that's right. It depends on your flux of mm-hmm. the right-handed neutrinos. I guess if you don't have any mixing, you have to rely on the photon production.
So what we didn't consider is that I produce an active state and I mix it into my right-handed neutrinos and then just mm-hmm. look for right-handed neutrino downscattering or into a active neutrino in the detector.
Yeah, that's another possibility. If you produce largely, a lot of N's, you can downscatter, yeah.
Yeah, because I still think an interesting question, like, ignore whatever's going on. Take what we think is the neutrino flux of the sun and ask how much can I mix it into another state? What is like the maximum signal I can get? I don't know the answer to that question. That's something I considered thinking about. Because like we only understand these things to a certain accuracy, right? You take what you measure in Borg-Sino for the different components of the flux and you go nuts and you see just how far can you push it before things blow up.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe somebody's already done this and I'm not aware of it, but I mean, I think it would be a reasonably interesting exercise to work out what's possible in the future.
All right.
This plot that you're showing, like the bounds that Darwinkle set or any future experiments, they not very well motivated theoretically. Am I interpreting that right? So why would you even look for these kind of things at Darwin?
Yeah, so I think if you're going to be completely honest, you look at this figure and you go like, guys, yeah. Just look for dark matter. Yeah. But what I had initially hoped that this Darwin reach would be below the bottom of the stellar cooling constraint, because then you can just say, I'm going to look for a vanilla magnetic moment in the active sector. But that's not the case, which is a bit sad. But I mean, if you consider like a normal neutrino magnetic moment in the active sector, you don't actually care about stellar cooling. Sorry, I'm getting tired. You don't actually care about stellar cooling because you're through the plasmon decay, you're again just creating active states. No, you do care. You do care. Oh. I'm going crazy. Sorry, Daniel. What I said first is correct. What I hoped is that limit went below, the Darwin projection went below the stellar cooling limit, because then you guarantee have something to look for.
So if you're going back to, if you ignore xenon, I mean, you guys have not put anything in the flavor violations, because the only UV completion you have that makes sense is the leptop quark one. Mm-hmm. So then you have the leptop quarks in the theory. So you have no idea where the parameter space would be.
At this exact moment in time, no, I don't. That has to be done to work out where this sits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because on xenon, you have tons of stuff excluding you.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to be completely honest, I think what you're saying is that cosmology is by far the most powerful probe of these scenarios.
Yeah, not only that, and supernova. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Those scenarios, those things are very hard to avoid. It's mm-hmm. not...
Yeah, I think the only region where you actually do a very good job of winning is this region up here. Above the supernova constraints where the particle gets trapped. Because this charm 2 yeah. constraint considers all the way, goes all the way down to the stellar cooling constraint.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you couldn't know before going with like calculating the bounds, but now that you know where the bounds lie, it looks a bit depressing for Darwin or...
I mean, I still haven't given up on the quest of how to actually enhance neutrino interactions. But like, I've tried quite a few things now, and it looks really grim. I'm sure Maxim would find a way, though.
And also, Micro-Moon has new bounds that... Don't they also have new bounds on sort of right-hand neutrinos that could improve on that region?
I think the Micro-Moon constraints also sit out here. At higher masses, and I don't think they're much better than mini boom, but I should double check that.
No, they don't do anything. Yeah,
microbrin's mainly a disappointing experiment.
For now, yeah.
Yeah, but hopefully they can fix things.
So the other thing is, you're only assuming a new mu coupling. What about mm-hmm. other types of flavors?
So new tau coupling changes, of course, these terrestrial experiments. They get relaxed a little bit. New E couplings, these terrestrial experiments get more constraining. There's not a huge difference between the flavors, and this is why I haven't gone to the effort of making all the figures for different flavors.
Mm-hmm.
The only kicker is basically electron flavor is much more strongly constrained by laboratory experiments.
Yeah.
As expected.
Toby, I got another meeting to go to. I really liked your talk. Very clear. Very nice.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.